Are we still on hold, guys?
I am, Shane. It's Marilyn.
Okay. Okay.
Are you still there, Elena?
Yep.
It may just be the three of us that can hear each other, though.
Okay.
All right. I think we're ready to go. Good morning, and welcome to the meeting of the Election Watcher Advisory Panel. I'm Suzanne Steyer, Deputy Secretary of State. Today, we will be focusing our attention and limit discussion to the watcher appointment and certification process. For any members of the public who are listening in to the audio broadcast, you may view the documents we will be reviewing on our website. For members of the panel who are participating through conference call line, please remember the conference call line is for panel members only. We would appreciate it if panelists participating over the phone mute their phones when they're not speaking to reduce feedback in the audio broadcast. If your phone does not have a mute function, you may use *6 to mute and unmute yourself. If we could just start with the panelists who are joining us over the phone today.
Yes, this is Shane Madsen.
This is Marilyn Marks.
Good morning, Elena Nunez here.
Good morning, Jean Albarico.
All right. And then for the panel members here in person, please remember to identify yourself and any documents you're referencing when speaking and try to speak directly into the microphone. We will have to share microphones today because of the room configuration. We'll be taking a break to provide lunch for the panelists around noon. And during the break, we will pause the audio broadcast and we will not be discussing any panel business or subject matter. If there are any panelists who need clarification on the reimbursement policy, please talk to one of our staff liaisons. And I think everybody got Wi-Fi access. Why don't we have the panelists just go around so we can get their voices identified and just tell us who you are. You want to start, Martha? Green. No, it doesn't. Does this work? Is this working? There you go.
It's a trick microphone. Martha Tierney, I am here on behalf of the Colorado Democratic Party.
Amber McReynolds, I'm the Director of Elections for Denver, and I'm representing the Clerks Association, one of the representatives.
Harvey Branscombe, seasoned election watcher.
Joanne Winholz, House Representative.
Karen Goldman, representing the Colorado Municipal Clerks Association and the Colorado Municipal League.
Jeff Wilson from CML.
Mickey Wadhams, representing Special Districts.
Good morning, Liz Olson from El Paso County.
Jim Candelari, Broomfield County.
Lisa Syriax, I'm unaffiliated.
State Senator Jesse Uliberry, apparently just on time.
All right, today we're going to hand things off to begin with to Ben Schler from our Elections Division, and he is going to facilitate much of our discussion today. It revolves around that appointment process, and I think they've done a process map of sort of how we think it is now, and we'll have discussion about whether that works and doesn't work. Go ahead, Ben.
Good morning, everybody. Sorry we're behind you here. We've got a limited number of microphones, so we're trying to give you guys the hot seats, and we'll just sit back here. For the four of you who are calling in, are you all able to see the screen with the process map up on it?
This is Shane. I'm working on it right now, but I'll listen carefully if I can't figure it out.
Sure, and
Ben, this is Marilyn. I can see it just now.
Great.
Thank you.
I can see it as well. This is Jean.
And Shane, if you're unable to get to it, there is a PDF copy of it on that Watcher website or on that last email that Steve Ward sent you with the other materials. So you can always pull that up on your screen.
Yeah, I've got all of that.
So let me just explain a little bit about what this map is and how we went about formulating it. The idea behind the map is to generate discussion and not to show you what we think the process ought to be, but more to give you an idea of how we have, through our own observations and also through some recent polling of the county clerk's offices, have come to understand the watcher appointment process. And we've identified areas within this map where we think that there is room for discussion. I'm sorry, just one second. Steve, I think there's a little bit later version of this map. Sure. Well, this one's fairly similar. Anyways, the idea behind the map is to give you an idea of what we from the Secretary of State's office, how we kind of see the watcher appointment process working. It's by no means set in stone in that we obviously know that most of you folks know better how the actual process works from a ground level. And so anything that we've, you know, included on this map today is extremely changeable, and that's kind of what our hope is. And so, like I said, we've identified some areas where we think that we can make some improvements, some areas where we just have some specific questions about how the process works. So we thought we would just get started with this map and move along through the process and see if we can't come to some agreement on different areas. This is kind of the very first area of the process for watchers, making sure that they're able to be appointed, that the appointment process isn't onerous, and that on the clerk side, the clerks are able to actually determine who the watchers are, whether they're qualified, and whether they've been properly appointed by the appointing entities. So just kind of the layout of this map, what you see on the far left side here in those boxes, starting with political party, these are what we basically call the roles for the process. And what we've identified are essentially three different appointing entities, the political parties, candidates, and issue committees. And we'll get to a different handout here a little later discussing what the current state of the law is with regard to who may appoint watchers and for what elections they're entitled to appoint those watchers. The other roles that we have are obviously the watcher, him or herself, the county clerk, and then the supervisor judge. And the reason that we've included supervisor judges is that our current rules basically establish that there needs to be a point of contact for watchers. And so we call it supervisor judge. That's certainly something we can change based on getting your all's experiences as to how this process actually works. So we'll just kind of kick it off right now with the first step in the process, which you can see down at the bottom comes from the county clerk, and that's providing the certificate of appointment to the appointing entities. That seems like a fairly simple process and not one that we would need to address, but it's actually something that we have found to be just simply not uniform across the state, applied differently among counties, among different appointing entities, and something where we saw some room for making it a little bit more of a uniform process to make sure that it's efficient both for the clerk and the watchers to be able to just get folks on the ground and not have a delay between when the watcher is able to actually get started watching, or to have confusion amongst the clerks as to whether or not that watcher's been duly appointed by a appointing entity.
And then we put these categories up, but these are traditionally the categories under Title I, and I think that some counties probably also have, and I don't know whether the cities are doing this through IGA, and so maybe you could just tell us, in your experience, if you have a city candidate that's on that ballot in a coordinated election, what does that watcher status look like? Can that candidate send somebody in? The same would be true of special districts. If you all have a Tabor issue or something on the ballot, what's your status with watchers? And I don't know whether that's a question for the clerks or the question for the cities. I don't know, Jim, do you? I know you, well, yeah. You probably don't have to coordinate, I guess, but you have city candidates or...
Jim Candelari, Broomfield. Yes, we do the coordinated elections, and city candidates can have watchers within Broomfield, but if we coordinate with a school district, for instance, they're allowed to have watchers also.
And then how do you, is the process the same? They appoint them and then you look them up and you sign the certificate, or is it different?
It's the same.
Okay.
It's the same. If there's a confusion on our part, it's identifying exactly who the appointing person is. That would be a confusion I think some clerks have. If it's Jim Jones, does he have the authority to appoint? If they're not on the committee, and also the timing, I think can be an issue for county clerks.
Okay. And Ben, do we know if that's uniform across the counties, or did we survey that?
For the appointment of municipal watchers.
Or special district watchers, yeah.
You know, we did not survey that. In fact, with regard to appointing entities, we kind of just took what our own understanding was. So I'm not sure if maybe the right thing for the map would be to just add an additional role for appointing entities for that type of thing for both municipal and special districts.
Well, for special districts, it's the same. A candidate can appoint one, and a proponent or opponent of an issue can appoint one. It's exactly the same.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah, so I was just having a discussion with Melissa about the particular law, and we can get into this when we look at the handout, but I think that aside from political party, that, you know, if you have candidate or issue committee, those are most likely going to be the folks who are appointing for special districts and municipalities. So kind of moving to our first topic here, with regard to providing the certificate of appointment, we had an idea ourselves based on what some counties do, which is that it would be a lot easier if we, as the Secretary of State, were able to just provide you all, as appointing entities and as counties, a single place to get that form. And not only to get that form, but to actually, you know, create on our website a place for both appointing entities and watchers to go to get any information that they need, something that we've not done in the past. We've actually never even posted the watcher form in the past, and one of the reasons for that is that we've experienced, or counties have experienced, folks who have brought in that watcher form, and then they've just simply have been unable to tell whether or not it was something that came from the appointing entity, or the watcher was confused and didn't know that they needed to be appointed. So our kind of idea behind this, and something we'd like to get feedback from the panel, is whether you all think it would be workable to have essentially a website that would provide, you know, maybe it would be something like, you know, two different links, you know, are you a watcher or are you appointing entity? And if you click one of those two, it takes you to a page that not only tells you kind of your rights and responsibilities, but also gives you the necessary information that you need. So I guess it'd be nice to hear from the panel if you all think that that would be something that would work, or whether you think that we would, you know, we might experience pitfalls putting that stuff up on the website.
Ben, this is Marilyn. Just a question on that. Are you assuming that would be basically an informational website, not really where somebody would file a document to be a watcher?
That's correct, Marilyn. The next topic that we'll get to, we'll talk about kind of some ideas we had around what we might call watcher certification, but it's a little bit different topic. So for the purpose of this topic, that's absolutely right. It would be an informational page and a page where you could access something like the watcher appointment form.
In that case, I think that'd be great.
Okay.
So this is Amber McReynolds from Denver. So we've actually had, and I've talked to the state about our process, and I know it's been very successful for the appointing entities as well as watchers. But on our website, we have all the rules and the statutes associated with watchers, kind of like a packet. And then we've created a template, and all it is in Microsoft Excel. So we create that for each election. And the appointing authority can go in and put their information in. So whatever their appointing authority is, they can also upload a JPEG image of the signature for the actual person that is the signatory for the authority. And then they can go into the sort of second tab. First tab kind of has instructions. Second tab is for the appointing authority. And then the third tab basically is a where they can enter in all of the people that they want to be watchers, along with their voter ID if they have it, their address, their name. And then we have basically a drop down of all the locations, including our ballot processing facilities, as well as all the VSPCs. And they can go through and select either all of them or some of them as they want. And then they basically, the appointing authority, all they need to do is send that template into us. And then we run a query check against the voter registration system to make sure they're registered in Colorado, and then just we basically auto-generate all the certificates for the entity and email them to them. So they don't have to come down, they don't have to get hard signatures, they don't have to do any of that. We just auto-generate all the certificates. And I think Martha's experienced that before, as well as the Republican chair used it last year. And it's been highly successful because it's made it easier for the appointing authorities and certainly easier for us, because then we can just email the certificates out. They can then distribute them through email to their various watchers. And we've also had it all on the website. So, I mean, I think it's been a much better process than the old process of appointing authorities sending in certificates that then we have to sign, look up, and sort of do manually. So I would advocate for something more like that, because it's definitely more efficient for all involved. And then, you know, we also, when we produce the certificates, if they select a certain number of sites, we actually print what sites they've selected right on the certificate with the address information for all the locations, all of that. So I think, you know, giving the counties the ability to sort of customize that based on their locations would probably be better than just sort of an auto-generated certificate by the state. But I'd be open to hearing what people think about that.
Could I just ask a question about the Denver process? This is Shane Madsen. Are all your communications routed through the appointing authority, or do they go directly to the watcher, or both?
We communicate with the appointing authority, and then once the watcher list is set, we also provide basically a packet to the appointing authority, and they can send that out to their watchers. And really all it does is it outlines all of our processes, contact okay. information for how to get in touch with anybody in our office for watchers or for the campaigns themselves. So we proactively communicate as opposed to, and really a lot of the reason we developed this is we had over 1,800 watcher certificates submitted to our office in 2008, which was actually more than the election judge count we had. And so to produce all of that paper and sort of verify all that manually was very inefficient.
So this is Martha Tierney. I just want to echo that Denver definitely, I think, has the best process going for watcher credentialing. And in particular, I want to highlight a couple things. The electronic use in terms of electronic signatures and having it, you have an automated system to get them all produced, incredibly streamlines the process for the appointing authority. I also think that you highlighted the 2008 issue, and I think that was maybe the year before, or maybe it was the year that we ultimately decided to do what we then called super credentials. So rather than having a watcher have to have a separate credential for every location, there was a credential that worked if it was marked that way in all locations. And that, I think, is a really also a better way to go, as long as it's made clear that that's a watch a certificate that works everywhere. So I'm a big fan of that process, and hope that we will, as a group, get somewhere close to that or mirror that. So I think we probably need to hear from some of the smaller counties. You know, every time Denver speaks, we have to then hear from the smaller county to see if, you know, that kind of process is going to work for them. I think that what we envisioned is mostly just providing the form, not being necessarily the clearinghouse for the approval, but rather have a standardized form. And that could be a form that somebody could, you know, take as a Word document and then modify, I think. It's just a matter of, you know, whether or not that works in small counties. I don't think asking small counties to do major website updates is realistic. So, you know, how do we use our website to best serve them and have them have the control over their best process? So maybe Jim, and then I know there's some people on the phone.
This is Jean Albrico from Garfield County, and I'm, you know, I'm not a small county. You know, voter registration wise, we're right with the big counties, but I am a medium, more a smaller county. I do have the luxury of having a 3-person election staff and more employees than some of the smaller counties do. For me, the timing is a big problem, because I think we need to adjust the expectation of when these documents should be filed. That, you know, with the change of how we do elections and stuff, it used to be most of the time they were showing up on just election day. But, you know, with all mail ballot and people wanting to see more of the central count processes, with early voting, the early voting times and the weekend voting and stuff, that changes kind of the timing of when it would be nice to have some of these appointments already in our hands, and not, you know, that Friday afternoon before the election is, you know, kind of doesn't fit the situation anymore, and I'd like to see that changed. And I think most counties would welcome some way to automate the process, and even smaller counties, I'm sure, would be able to adapt to a template or something doing that, maybe not to the level that Denver does.
It's Jim Candelari. I like the way Amber described the process. Like Jean, we have just a 2-person office. And similar to Denver, oftentimes we have more watchers than we have judges. And so I would think that would work extremely well for counties if it was done on the Secretary of State's website. And the Secretary of State could also, I would like it if they would create some rules to identify that appointing authority, so that we know that that's legitimately coming from the authority. And I see some real advantages to Denver's process.
Jim, when you say you know it's coming from the authority, are you saying there have been issues with whether that's like a legitimate appointment? You don't know whether that's really an issue committee that's registered that way, or what do you mean by that?
Both. Oftentimes, we will get the issue committee will have names that are very different than the ones that sign for the appointment. There have been times when issue committees just pop up the same day of a watcher appointment, and I would like to get into that discussion also, because I just have concerns in that. Watchers being appointed, either a yes or no, that they can create additional committees and really offset the balance in a voting location or that type of thing. It's a real problem for us as far as space, staff, etc.
This is Joanne Winholz, state rep, but I'm also Adams County. I think just having the consistency would be very, I don't want to say the word comforting, but it would be at least knowing everybody was on somewhat the same page when it came to issuing those certificates. Timing will be an issue when it comes to issues that are on the ballot at the last minute, but if the majority of what we do could be done on a consistent basis, I think that would eliminate a lot of misgiving.
This is Lisa Syriac. I'm an unaffiliated voter and have worked
elections in Sawatch County, which is a very rural county with a small population but a lot of land area. So I like the idea of centralizing a location the clerks can access ahead of time, because it's not even an issue anymore with polling places, but because we only have one vote center based on our population at the courthouse itself. But people who want to participate may have to drive 45 or 50 miles to get to the courthouse, or if they have to connect with a particular political party leader in order to make that happen. So I think standardizing the process, because in it, my experience has been, I mean, our county clerk has been very cooperative, except she always checks with the Secretary of State anyway, which sometimes can delay it by a day if she's not available or if she can't access the person that she needs. So if she has some confidence that she's using a standardized form, I think it makes all the difference.
And this is Harvey Branscombe from a middle-sized county, Eagle County. I am in favor of consistency and in favor of access to the rules and law about watchers and access to the proper forms and so forth. All of those things mentioned as a function of a Secretary of State's website. I did hear a few things that caused me some concern, though, about stretching the function of that website beyond providing the forms, providing information. I heard Jim Candelari mention balance, and I don't think balance is a piece of the formula for watching. For judges, yes. For watching, because watching is not a decision-making role. It's an information-providing role. And therefore, if there's an unbalance in watchers, that is not a problem for election integrity, as far as I understand. I do recognize there might be some questions about the authority of an authorizing entity. Based on the confusion about names, I heard you mention that. What I want to make very strongly, I want to make the point strongly right now, that is not clear in statute that the designated election official or the county clerk and recorder has the right to prevent a watcher from being authorized. And that there's and that the way the statute reads, as far as I understand it, is there's a submission of the name takes place, but there's no actual response to that called for in statute. And that, in fact, it's the certifying authority which has the responsibility along the lines of individual responsibility to make sure that that watcher is eligible, and that there would be a challenge process that would be the remedy for an improperly certified watcher, not a step that has to take place where the county clerk and recorder can stand in the way of the appointment of a watcher, because that actual process can actually be an obstacle to watching, which can be used to unfortunate effect or potentially beneficial effect. But in any case, I don't think the law supports it. I don't think the law should. I think it should be relatively easy to become a watcher, and there should be a process for challenging a watcher. And there is a process for removal of a watcher.
This is Marilyn, and I would just like to echo what Harvey said. I completely agree that unless there is some significant evidence of people being unauthorized and impersonating watchers, watchers should be challenged once they're actually in doing their work, just like you would challenge a voter in the process of voting if they were ineligible. The eligibility should really be the responsibility of the appointing authority. And if we get to a place where we are,
I think we're kind of jumping ahead on issues. I mean, Harvey jumped.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that
Harvey jumped way ahead when he talked about the formula for watcher to judge. I mean, that's a discussion for an entirely different day. The discussion, I mean, right now we're really trying to focus one at a time. This issue of what does the appointment look like, we have some ideas coming up on what we've mapped out. I think that there has to be some balance. There have to be some credentials, and that's how we've always interpreted it. And I think that, we've worked with the parties primarily because they're the ones who have the majority of the watchers to try to streamline that credential process. But I don't think we're going to get to we can have that discussion here in about an hour. But Ben, why don't you go ahead with what we're really just trying to focus on. Would it be helpful to have a standardized form? Would it be helpful to have, you know, that kind of standardized process? What that process is and the substance of it is sort of a different issue.
Sure. This is Ben. And it sounds like it seems pretty agreed upon that to have something, you know, centralized for at least this form and appointment process would be something that folks are interested in, and you know, we can certainly work a little bit more with Denver too to understand the process better, so that we make sure that when it's something that we would transition to our website to provide the form or whatever we provide, that we're not reinventing the wheel and understanding, you know, what processes already work. With that kind of in mind, that it seems like everyone's amenable to, you know, having a form up on the website. Just to kind of move to another topic that is also related to the website, aside from it being a place where you can receive the form, it also be a place where you can get information about how to become a watcher or the process for appointing a watcher. One of the things that folks brought up during the last meeting, and one of the issues that we've had brought up on several occasions, is kind of the tension, for lack of a better word, that is caused when you have a statute that allows watchers to observe election activities, and then at the same time, you don't have currently a process or it is not clear about the extent to which a watcher can see things like personally identifiable information when they're doing things like signature verification and the like. And we'll certainly get into the signature verification process and other processes like that later. But with regard to the website and appointment, one of the things that we were considering here at the state is that there's kind of what we've seen, there's kind of two different types of watchers. There are the seasoned watchers like Harvey, who are perennial watchers, who have a level of sophistication about the process, and then there's another group of watchers who are not unsophisticated, but have likely taken a training. It might be their first time acting as a watcher, and they may very well be showing up, you know, day of the election, day of a specific VSPC being open, and they're there to conduct a more traditional role that a watcher performed prior to this new voting scheme that we have. And so what we've been struggling with is how do we ensure proper training? How do we ensure that we're making sure that folks are taking the proper oath and are under the proper obligation if they are going to be seeing things like personally identifiable information, if they're viewing signature verification? And so one of the things we came up with that we'd like the panel to weigh in on is whether there might be something of more of a two-tiered type of watcher program, wherein if you are the type of watcher who's going to go to the central count location or the county clerk's office where they're doing things like signature verification, doing things like ballot duplication, that you might be taking one extra step in order to basically show that you've kind of done the things that judges do, which is taken a training and taking a proper oath and become certified. So my long spiel is the idea that we would have a subset of watchers that would be certified, something that, you know, we could do through the state, which would be, for example, and something we could discuss, you know, an online training that would give the watcher an idea of his or her rights and responsibilities, and give them a little bit more meat to what it is that they're bringing when they go to do that thing. And then we would actually, after the watcher's gone through that process, certify that watcher and make sure that all counties know that watcher for, say, that year is certified to be that kind of tier one watcher who can observe things like signature verification and the like. And then you would have the other type of watcher where you don't necessarily have to go through that process, but you also are not entitled to the type of access that the watcher who went through that process is. So I guess that would be the next thing we'd like to hear from the panel about.
Ben, this is Marilyn. So long as that type of watching and certification was completely optional and it didn't give anybody permission or access to anything over anybody else, you know, I think that that's fine. But the statutes do not in any way require this kind of thing. And I think that in order to encourage more watchers, as well as have watchers ready to run into difficult situations, the training should really be up to the appointing authority. And whatever their needs may be, they may be very narrow. So on whatever particular issue there is, I think it's great to have it optional, but I would not support it being mandatory.
Marilyn, this is Shane Madsen. So regardless of access to personal information, et cetera, you want it all voluntary?
Well, I think that the personal information is a separate question. And I think that the statutes would indicate that, that watchers have access to everything. So I think that's perhaps a separate discussion. But yes, the training should be encouraged, but it should definitely be voluntary.
Well, let me just say from the Secretary of State's perspective, we have agreements with the counties that, you know, they can't show SCORE information that, you know, has personally identifying information in it. And so we're trying to find, you know, some mechanism to, you know, allow that. And it may take a statutory change because, you know, we can have people sign an oath and the oath that it talks about watcher signing has nothing to do with personal identifying information. And so, you know, as I guess one of the lawyers in the room, and we can hear from the other lawyers, but I've never been very comfortable with just adding things to the oath that aren't in the statute and thinking that it means anything. You know, I can ask somebody to sign it, but if I have no statutory authority to have them sign that oath, then I'm going to err on the side of not handing out that personally identifying information, because we have conflicting statutes in that regard. We have statutes that say we don't release personal identifying information, and then we have a statute that, you know, you all are interpreting to mean you have access to everything. And I think those two are in conflict. And if we're not willing to have a discussion about, you know, having a two-tiered system where we would have certain watchers that would, you know, sign that oath and agree to take the training to be able to view that personally identifying information, then, you know, that's going to inform our choices going forward. And so, you know, if you want to take the position that, you know, everybody should have access to everything and they should not have to take training and they should not have to be credentialed, then when we get down the road to having these other discussions about what you have access to, you're going to find that it's less rather than more. So I think at this point, you know, people need to think about whether there's a compromise to be made or not. And so I guess I'd like to hear from, you know, some of the administrators too about how they feel about that. I mean, ultimately it's our voter registration database and we're going to make that decision about whether to modify that agreement with the counties. So, you know, they're kind of in the position that they have to follow what they've signed with us. And I don't know that they have a lot of room in that regard right now.
Well, I was going to, I think back to what Ben was outlining in terms of availability on the website of various things, I would add like the training piece. So if there is some sort of standardized online training presentation that watchers could use, I think that's very valuable because in 2012, I personally attended a training being conducted by an outside group that came in from outside of Colorado. They had already trained over 100 people before I had been at the training I saw, and they were using Texas law to train, and they were incorrectly training people about, and it was one of the biggest issues was that they were basically telling all these folks that were going to be watchers that when a voter flees the voting booth or flees the machine at the voting location, that vote should be canceled. And that's not Colorado law, that's Texas law. Colorado means it should be cast. So that's just one of the issues that they were incorrectly training. But they had already trained over 100 watchers that ended up getting dispersed across Colorado. And so I think that if watchers, you know, they either should utilize a training provided by the Secretary of State, or perhaps the Secretary of State could, you know, sign off on maybe the training that the appointing authorities or the entities are providing their watchers. But I think that is a big component, and there's been significant problems historically with that not being done correctly. So I think I definitely support, and I know that's a different topic than this, but it is part of the appointment process. So thanks.
This is Jim with Broomfield. I'd like to echo Amber's thoughts on that. I think most county clerks have witnessed watchers having misinformation. I think that the Secretary of State does a fairly good job as far as their training for election judges online, and the consistency of information would be invaluable from my perspective.
This is Martha. Both the major political parties have pretty robust watcher trainings, and we actually share our materials, and I think we're pretty confident that while we differ on a few points, we're pretty confident that the training is pretty good. What I would like to see is if we could, I'm not at all opposed to having a Secretary of State training, but maybe there would be a way that we could incorporate that training into our own training as well, so that folks, because I don't think the major political parties are ever going to not train. And so it would be nice if we could find a way to do it in one training, like if we could make sure that what you guys have in your training is also in our training and you sign off on it, and then somehow we provide a record of who took it, because we make everybody take it. And we put on probably 6 trainings every election cycle or more. Some are web-based, some are, lots of them are in person. And we do travel around the state, in, particularly in presidential cycles. So I think the consistency would be great, but I would also not want the redundancy. So maybe there'd be a way we could work to put it together.
Martha, what about the issue of the kind of the two-tiered? I mean, what are your feelings on the PII?
Well, it gets into the what I hope we're going to have a long discussion about, and that's the role of the watcher. Because I guess I'm not opposed to it. I have a pretty strong opinion about what the role of the watcher is, and I'm not so sure that my opinion jibes with everyone else's. So if we're going to go down that road, which I'm not sure that I will agree with, but I'll wait until we get there to decide. Then I think we have to have a better process to ensure confidentiality. And whether that's a statutory change that then results in an oath change and separate trainings, maybe that's the way we have to go. One of the things that I hope we're going to talk about is the difference between the watcher role and the election judge role. They are not the same. And we have to make sure that those stay separate, because the watchers are not the judges. And if we're going to turn the watchers into the judges, then let's just turn them into the judges. Not have watchers and judges be called the different things, but do exactly the same thing. So that, and maybe I'm jumping ahead, but I think that's got to be a critical discussion for this group.
Yeah. This is Liz from El Paso County, and I'll just offer my opinion. I certainly agree that training
is necessary, so I support that. The information, or of the information I have so far of the two-tier training, I certainly support that as well. And I think there are watchers, I know there are a lot of watchers that have done this for many, many years, and I appreciate their knowledge, but there are a lot of watchers that we get that they've never done this before. And I think they would appreciate the training because they come into our office and they say, okay, I walk them around, I show them the operation, but then at the end they're saying, okay, what should I do? What should I be watching? And so I think that they would appreciate the training as well. And I would even love to go as far as saying that as a department manager, I would love to be involved in local training and at least be invited so we can listen in, as Amber said, so we know what's going on. I search for training that's going on in our county by the means that I have, which is the internet, but I never ever find anything, so I'm not very often able to attend that, and I would love to see something where the counties are involved in that as well, because I would certainly participate.
This is Representative Joanne Winholtz. My concern is, so we have two-tier training. What do each of those consist of? Is tier one just the online training, and then is tier two a step up that tier one could go to tier two, then tier two could talk to the judges? You know, it's kind of determine what, where are we drawing the line? So I think we've got to be very careful on that. And it would be helpful, you know, and that people actually know what their responsibilities are. And if there's too many chiefs and not enough Indians, we just end up running around in circles.
This is Lisa Syriax from Swatch County again. And for smaller counties, it's a totally different story. I mean, we have one vote center, and all the ballot processing happens there. And it's essentially a room that's maybe about the size of this square of tables right here. So having two tiers of watchers doesn't really seem to apply. I do think the training is important, you know, and in my time at Swatch County, we had two clerks that had the watchers train with the judges and two clerks who refused to let that happen. And from my experience, I don't think either party has ever offered a training for judges or watchers. They rely on the clerks to handle that. There does seem to be a difference of interpretation, so I think clarifying the rules and Martha's point about the role, I think, is really important. Because again, in my experience, you know, when I first moved to Colorado, watchers, a big part of their role was determining who had showed up and who had voted on behalf of your candidate or your party. And that's really no longer applicable or could be handled by looking at the voting lists of what ballots have been turned in. So the watchers become more of some sort of an oversight to make sure something inappropriate isn't happening or that one candidate isn't being favored over another by the judges or any of the people that are staffing the election. So, you know, I'm not sure distinguishing two types of tiers. I mean, we've frankly, and it's a small county and it's a small town, and, you know, gossip is a big issue, as it always is in small towns. Confidentiality has never been an issue. People who have taken the oath as a watcher or as an election judge have never disclosed any of the information, you know, not on a general broad spread basis. I mean, I can't really speak to what people might have spoken to a spouse or to a close friend. So, you know, I'm not sure that that's really a big issue.
Well, I think when we talk about the tiers, I mean, essentially what we're talking about is, I mean, we're back to this PII issue. And I know that when I say PII, I'm not talking about Social Security numbers. What I'm really talking about is the signatures and the second tier review of the signatures, which once the signature comes in, if there's an issue with it and it gets elevated to the second tier, then that second tier goes into our database, which then pulls up things like dates of birth and other things that under CORA we're not supposed to release and our personal identifying information. So our concern at the secretary's office, and I'm sure this is shared by many people, is what is that balance? You know, right now we have watchers in the room looking at signatures, and the oath that we have them take has no teeth to it, because the only oath they're required to take by statute says they won't release results after 7, and it maybe says they're a registered elector. It doesn't say anything about this confidential information. And, you know, they have an ability. I mean, we say no video recording, but, you know, unlike judges, they do have their, you know, their phones and their tablets in there. And, you know, it's a concern that, you know, you're trying to say, I'm a watcher, I should have rights to all of this information, but I shouldn't have any of the obligations that the judges have to, you know, agree that I'm not going, you know, to have to take the same kind of training that a judge takes. And that's a big concern to us, that, you know, we've tried to balance that, but we haven't done it, you know, all that well, quite frankly, because we have this issue come up, you know, every single time at every election. And so what I'm really talking about is those kinds of issues. And I think we need to get to a point where there's a little give, quite frankly, from the watcher side, that if you're going to have access to this information, you're going to be willing to take the same kind of training that the judges are going to take, and you're going to be willing to, you know, sign the same kind of oath with the same kind of teeth. And if that's not something we're going to get from, you know, the watcher side, that's fine. We can vote as a committee and decide whether we want to present that, you know, in law later. But that's really the discussion I'm having. And I just have never seen much give on the watcher side on that issue that I think, quite frankly, is a very important issue.
Well, except that I'm looking at the certificate of appointment and oath of the watcher that was circulated, which is the same form that our county clerk used. And it does say that I will not attempt to determine how any elector voted or record or disclose any confidential voter information I may observe. Now, right. I don't know if it has any teeth.
No, but, you know, I mean, I can see if the other attorneys in the room agree with me. But sure, we put that in the oath because we don't want watchers to do that. But that's not in the statute. I mean, we put something in an oath and try to, you know, and we get people to sign the oath saying they won't do it. But if they did, I don't know that I would have any recourse, because I don't have any statutory authority for that oath beyond my rule. So I put it in the rule, but there's no criminal penalty, or there's no penalty on the other end for violating that rule, because although a rule has the force and effect of law, it doesn't have a component of enforcement to it, except to go to a district court and get an injunction to get you to stop doing it in the future, or to remove you as a watcher. But there is no criminal penalty as would apply to a clerk who did that, or would apply to a judge who did that, or you know, somebody who statutorily has agreed not to do that, and it would therefore be an election offense for them to do it. So, you know, we have an oath out there because we're hopeful people will follow the oath, and we have it in rules so that we have some mechanism to go to court. But no, there's no criminal penalty for the watcher who reveals how someone voted because they inadvertently found out. Criminal penalty to reveal personal identifying information, or to take pictures of signature screens or PII screens. There's no criminal penalty.
But, you know, I wonder, I mean, I can't recall where the Secretary of State has chosen to prosecute criminal behavior on the part of a clerk or an election judge if they should exhibit that same
kind of prosecute.
Why the level of concern?
We don't prosecute. I mean, that's...
Who would do the prosecuting?
It would be the DAs.
The DAs. Yeah. So somebody would have to turn it in.
Sure, and DAs investigate election offenses all the time, but they couldn't do this one because there's no criminal penalty.
Well, this is Harvey Branscombe. So I'm sure that information will come as a big surprise to the watchers out there who signed that oath, who probably expected that they actually were bound to maintain the words that are in the oath. And this is really deep inside baseball, it sounds like. But I'm surprised this isn't a whole extra separate topic. However, I believe that the correct solution to this problem is actually to prevent the need for confidentiality of information within the election to the extent possible. And that definitely can be done better than we're doing it today by moving the confidential information off the screens that the election judges are using, except in specific cases where it's necessary, and moving into a place where they could be hidden if necessary. Or there are many ways throughout the election system we could actually handle the information that really is confidential, and there isn't that much of it. Should be very little.
The signatures are PII, Harvey. So what do you do with that?
Yeah. Then the signature shouldn't be visible on the outside of the envelopes we send through the mail either, right? I mean, really, there, each one of these issues has a caveat to it that you have to consider. You know, the counties have stopped putting tabs over the signatures, so they actually are exposed now in many cases. Not all, no, not all, no. Not the majority, says a clerk, election official next to me. The as far as the original question, though, I haven't spoken on that yet, and I actually think that it is very valuable for watchers to be exposed to training and to the law and so forth. I'm in favor of that. I'm in favor of watching the process of training the election judges, by the way. And I think watchers should be encouraged and not discouraged, and I believe they might be discouraged in some cases from watching training. That's the kind of thing that watchers nowadays probably should be at, and the parties and the traditional thought about watching in the past wouldn't have considered that to be within the range of watching, but it seems very appropriate now. And I'm in favor of watchers getting access to the same information that the election officials are giving to the judges. And by the way, I want to say right now, I am absolutely clear that watching and election judging are different tasks. So watching is clearly an information processing role, and judging is a decision-making role, very, very different. However, the access to information ideally is the same. We shouldn't have a tier for election judges and a tier for watchers. And if it's necessary for watchers to be trained to a certain level in order to achieve the full access that election judges have and be able to communicate with election judges, maybe that's a good idea. But it's important to see how it's actually implemented and if that actually ends up being an obstacle to the kind of watching that we actually need. So conceptually, I'm in favor of the idea, depending on the implementation, with the proviso that understanding that in small counties, there are a small enough number of people involved that it's hard to imagine that you would have any need for two different kinds of watchers there. I mean, and also we've got counties where there's no watching going on at all. So we actually need to think about encouraging watching rather than making it difficult. So from that point of view, I'd like to make sure that the two-tier process actually, you know, is part of a process to make it clear to the citizens why watching is important and to encourage them to actually do it.
So. Suzanne, this is Marilyn.
Hang on.
I wanted to ask a question.
Marilyn, can we got one more comment and then we'll get to yours.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear it. Thank you.
Sorry about that. State Senator Jesse Uliberry. I wanted to ask Deputy Director Steyer about this because it's not explicit in your authorization, but any oath that has the effect of law, I think I was dealing with this in a different context this session, is seen as perjury and could be a misdemeanor too. And I was dealing it within a healthcare context earlier this year where it was issued by rule, the oath was issued by rule, but you did have to, if you violated the oath, you were committing perjury. So I do think there may not be explicit authorization for criminal prosecution, but there is implicit understanding that a violation of oath would be a prosecutable offense if you had a DA who was willing to charge. Just wanted to make them.
Okay. So not as an election offense, but as a perjury?
Yep.
Okay.
Suzanne, the question I was going to ask is, what is exactly the question on the table right now? Is that whether or not training should be mandatory, or are we trying to answer the question of how watchers should be properly restricted from disclosing private information?
Well, I think it was kind of a little of both of those. It was, should there be some kind of mandatory training for watchers who would have access to the material that we consider PII. So this tier two. So your watchers who go out to the VSPCs, that's not really an issue. These would be watchers who are doing signature verification, essentially. That's where most of the PII issues come in, or watching the download of UACABA ballots. Should there be some kind of additional training for those watchers required in order to watch in those circumstances?
Okay. Not to be repetitive, but just to make sure that we're clear, I thought I was originally understanding that there were some people recommending that watcher training be required for everything, even if we were asking the watcher, hey, sit here and watch this ballot box and make sure nobody steals it. And that's his only job. I was saying that certainly shouldn't be require mandatory training. Are we together on that page that for your casual watcher, we're not requiring mandatory training? We're encouraging it, but not requiring it. Is that where people are on that?
That's what we're asking.
This is Jean from Garfield County, and you know, when you start putting tiers in, I think training is absolutely necessary, whether it's found on the Secretary of State's website or it's done by the parties, or if the clerk has a great relationship with the local parties and stuff, and they do local training. But when you get into different tiers and stuff and who can do what, that gets more complex. And I would disagree that just the central counting and that kind of stuff is where the PII is, because we're doing voter registration at VSPCs, and so if they want to watch that process, then, you know, how do you determine who at a voter center who gets to just watch what's going on and who gets to come around and watch what's happening when somebody's registering to vote? You know, I agree there's some kind of training and certification needed, but not necessarily agree with a tiered process.
Suzanne, this may come back to Senator Uliberry's point, which I thought was a very good one. When we have voter registration drives, I believe the people who are operating in the voter registration drive, although I don't know a lot about it, are required by us, probably in rule, although it's not in statute, to maintain the confidentiality of what they are seeing. Is that correct? And if so, is there a way to use that as a model?
Sure, we can use that as a model, because they're all required to take training and wear badges and do all kinds of things.
I'm talking about the oath.
Oh, just the oath.
I'm not familiar with it, but I'm assuming that they have one.
Yeah, they take the oath at the training.
This is Karen. I guess I'm confused, and I don't understand what the problem with mandatory training is. There was a comment about a casual watcher, somebody who's only supposed to look at watch a ballot box to make sure nobody steals a ballot, although I don't know how that would happen. But in any event, so the first time the casual watcher watches a ballot box, and then in the primary, and then several months later in a general election, the watcher graduates to watching the ballot counting process. I mean, it seems to me that if you're going to have people assume different roles, you know, and get, I'm tired of watching the ballot box, it's boring, whatever, why wouldn't we want somebody to be trained in all aspects of the role of the watcher at the get-go, and then they decide, they have the opportunity to decide. So I haven't heard why mandatory training is really a bad idea. And I think the other, Harvey, you made a comment that you would like to have watchers watch the training. Well, why, if you're going to watch the training, why don't you just have them take the training? I mean, I'm really having a problem understanding why mandatory training is considered to be a terrible thing. So I think it would be very, very important for people to understand, because it will help them understand what their role is, which I know we're going to get into in some kind of further meeting.
Well, I'm just trying to figure out where that leaves us. I think if we were to do mandatory training, that may require a statutory change. And maybe that's why I wasn't leaning that way. I don't know. I think if we do it as sort of a compromise to the PII, then we, you know, do that through process or rule, and we're probably okay. But I think if we're going to get into some kind of mandatory training issue, then that's probably something we need to go back to the legislature to put into place, because that's not a prerequisite right now to being a watcher. Now, I think if you're giving them something, which is kind of, you know, a super watcher credential, then... so that's probably why I didn't go there in the beginning, but maybe that's something we want to discuss as a group is, you know, taking that issue back to the legislature to require it.
So this is Harvey Branscombe. Here's the quick answer to that. One of the answers is that watching tends to respond to the actual election results at the time. So there will be a lot more watchers suddenly, or a need for watchers, a desire for watchers to watch at the time when an election is suddenly known to be close. And then there would be great difficulty providing that there wouldn't be time for training at that point. So that's why watching needs to be somewhat flexible. So we need to include that consideration in it. That's one of the reasons.
So how does the committee feel? I mean, do people want to propose that we do mandatory training? I mean, maybe we should take it in the different steps. Like, do we want to just have training be optional? I think those are the things we've heard. Training is completely optional. Training is part of a tiered process to get to the PII, or training is mandatory for everyone, period. Is that the three we heard, Ben?
Those are the three that I heard, yes.
Okay. I don't know that we have consensus, and so maybe we want to who all thinks that training should be mandatory for everyone. The result would be that we would go back to the legislature and do that in a bill.
You need to specify whether these are exclusive or optional. We can vote for any one of the three, or both, two out of three, etc.
Sure, you can vote for however many you want.
And Suzanne, do you mind just elaborating just a little bit on how you all might envision that training for the purposes of the PII?
Well, I think
if the training is really just for that, and not, you know, like a 7-week course in how to watch, you know, I think that makes a big difference.
Yeah, we're talking about an e-learning 1-hour video, probably. Whether there's a quiz at the end, we haven't got to. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a video and then maybe some questions at the end. And then you
for the PII access.
Right.
Okay.
I like
that.
All right. Well, let's talk about mandatory for everyone. We'll just do it by a show of hands and then on the phone. Who would support mandatory training for every watcher? I got in the room. I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I'll go 8. And anyone on the phone support mandatory for all?
This is Shane. I'm really coming at this question from a more nuanced concern about access to PII. And I want to think through the mandatory training because I think it could be simplistic and it could be helpful for everybody involved in this process. And I just don't see the argument that somehow this category of casual watcher that stumbles onto a site, you know, motivated by a radio story that they heard an hour before, that bothers me. So I want to think about it a little bit more.
Okay.
For the mandatory, we're saying that if the appointing authorities, so say the political parties, want to incorporate some version of whatever you guys come up with into their training, they could do that. They wouldn't have to be that they have to go through your, right? Is that kind of what we're saying? So one of the two. You either take the course online or it's incorporated into something they do in the
field. And we certify theirs.
And that's what I think. I think there should be the option.
Yeah.
Okay. So to clarify, you're saying the Secretary of State would determine the content and certify the training that would be given.
Right. And then the appointing authority would have to certify that they took that training or they'd take it on our website.
So the certifying authority would still be the appointing entity?
Yes.
Okay.
So the party or the issue committee or whomever. I mean, I think in practical, the parties will have their own training and then everyone else will use the secretary's training.
So would that be defined through rules and we'd be yes. back to talking about the role?
Well, we'd have
point?
To go for a statutory change to mandate the training and then there would probably be some rulemaking after that.
Okay. Because that's my reservation about the mandatory is who determines the content and the role of the watchers, because again, it's entirely subjective. You know, I've worked with four county clerks and they all have different interpretations of watchers and
well,
what they can and cannot do.
We're hoping that by the time we get to the end of this committee in June, at the end of June, that maybe it won't be quite as, right? I mean,
okay.
We're talking about going back for some legislation. I mean, there's three different things we can do. We can do legislation, we can do rules, and we can do best practices. Now, you can always do best practices, but the authority for legislation and rules are a little bit different. And this is one that would take a legislative change, I think. So this would be one that we would go back in our sort of collaborative bill next year and ask for some of these things. Now, we may try to roll them out as best practices in the next election to see how they work. But ultimately, the goal would be to have this in a bill before the legislature, mandating the training.
Right. So, you know, just again, I think the cautionary note is the legislature is typically Republican or Democrat, and you have at least a third of the registered voters who aren't either party, you know, who may not feel that their interests are protected by a two-party system.
Well, that's a much broader conversation about our representative government, but
I'm just bringing it up. So this is Martha. I want to follow up on something that Lisa said. One of the benefits of a mandatory training would be that you are right. I mean, right now we do have, in some cases, 64 different interpretations of what a watcher can and cannot do. I would hope that if we go down this road, that the development of the training, you would invite stakeholders to help with that so that we could get a training that everybody thought was, you know, the right kind of training. And then I want to make one more point, and that's that speaking from the Democrats, and I know from the Republicans as well, the training historically has been much more, and I envision it would be more comprehensive than your training. Like, for example, on the Democratic side, we talk a lot about challenges, when you can do them, when you can't do them, a lot about when you can't do them. And I imagine that would not be a focus of the secretary. You'd probably talk about them, but we would talk about them maybe more extensively. So what I would hope is that to the extent that the parties do their own trainings, that to the extent they incorporate the secretary training, the mandatory training, that you would not tell us that we can't train on our own stuff.
No, because your training to, I mean, you know, your goal is different than my goal.
Right. Right. But we both have the same goal of making sure that watchers understand the role.
Right, right. But my training is more, you know, just recitation of the law, and your training is, you know, more geared toward, I guess, protecting your candidates or, you know, that type of thing. So
it's strategic, in other words.
All right. So did we have anyone else on the phone who was a yes on that? I think we had 9 yeses.
Yes.
All right.
This is Elena. I would support mandatory training, assuming that entities have the ability to incorporate it into their own training and it's not something that's solely through the Secretary of State. And I do think the value is that there's some consistent application of what the roles and responsibilities of a watcher are. So I think that that's a great value add.
Okay. All right.
This is Jean. I would support the mandatory training as well.
All right. So who do we have that's a no on the mandatory training?
Suzanne, it's Marilyn. I'm a no on the mandatory training.
Okay, so we have three that are a no on the mandatory. Well, I think that that's a pretty solid majority. We probably don't need to go to the next votes. All right. Ben, why don't you move to the next issue?
Sure, and just to let you folks know, if you haven't noticed it, we have our paper map that's up too, and we're taking copious notes here. And so obviously a lot of the questions have been centered around what's the training going to look like and what's going to be in the training, and we envision that the next few meetings of this panel will very much dictate what that is. And so just rest assured that we're taking into account the things that you all are saying, and we appreciate it, and so we'll certainly make sure that that's part of the training. So the next topic that we get to on our process map here, step two, is selecting a potential watcher by the appointing entity. And in order to kind of fire us up on that before we kind of ask the appointing entity folks in the room to give us a little understanding of how that works, we have another thing that Steve can pull up on here that is just kind of a quick summary of the current state of the law with regard to who may appoint watchers at different types of elections. And I'm going to let Melissa kind of give a little bit of a synopsis on that.
Hi, everyone. This is Melissa. We put together this quick little chart based upon the rules and statutes that talk about appointing entities. So the first that we have is who may appoint at a primary election. This information, and I'll give you the statutory citations. We may add this into this chart just for people's reference. So this is something that we contemplated that would be a resource on our website. You know, if you go to the Watcher website, people could very easily determine, okay, who can appoint, you know, this is a primary election, who can appoint a watcher in this election. So the first on our upper left hand is a primary election. That's under Title I on 1-7-105, outlines the entities and specifically who in that entity can appoint watchers. And then we have general elections, which is in 1-7-106. We have participating political parties whose candidates are on the ballot, each issue committee who has an issue on the ballot, each unaffiliated and write-in candidate whose name is on the ballot, and this list also applies to a congressional vacancy under 1-7-106. Then we move on to nonpartisan elections, and this is under 1-7-107. So candidates on the ballot in a nonpartisan election and proponents and opponents of ballot issues on the ballot can appoint in those elections. Then we'll move to canvass. 1-10-101 outlines who can be a watcher at the canvass. So each minor political party who has a candidate on the ballot and each unaffiliated candidate whose name is on the ballot can appoint watchers for canvass. In recount, that's under Rule 8.8, the Secretary of State's Rules 8.8, and that's any political party, candidate, or issue committee involved on the ballot. In the recount, I'm sorry. And then recall, so I will note, this is under Election Rule 1.1.46. We are modifying this rule. It occurred to us that recall elections have issues, essentially. It's a recall issue. And so we'll be modifying this, and you'll see that in our proposed rules to include, you know, participating parties. We'll also include, you know, basically any successor candidate that's on the ballot and any recall issue committees, both proponents and opponents of that recall. And so we'll be modifying that, and you'll be able to see that in our proposed rules. But as it is right now, that's under Rule 1.1.46. And right now it just states that they are appointed as in primary. And so that's why this reflects that, but that will be changing. Does anybody have any questions about this chart or authorized appointing entities?
Uh,
Okay, so now that you kind of have a little bit of the lay of the land, we have, at least with respect to the parties, we've got some folks here who have done some appointing. And one of the questions that we had, because we, from our end, and the counties may be able to shed some light too, have not had specific experience with the actual appointment process. And so we were just kind of hoping to get a little bit of background from you all as to how you select your watchers.
Okay, I can start with that. This is Martha. We have a fairly large file of people who've been watching year after year after year. So we start with that file and email everyone and say, do you want to watch this year? If so, we have a link that they sign up on our website, the Colorado Dems website. And then once they sign up, they get in the queue and we start notifying them about what the dates that are available and when the trainings are and so on and so forth. And that file is thousands of people now, so it's a big file. But we also do a lot of recruitment, and we try to use lawyers where we can. So we do a lot of law firm recruitment. We'll identify someone in a law firm to be our point of contact and ask them to make the pitch in their law firm and then get those lawyers to sign up on our website. We also send out a blast from the political party to all of the people who are in the political party's database to say, are you interested in being a watcher? Again, we like lawyers if we can get them, because we want people who understand the legal ramifications, but not everybody has to be a lawyer. We certainly have some non-lawyers who watch, but we seek out lawyers if we can get them. So we do a blast. We have law firm recruitment contacts. We have the candidates also do recruiting, both the state level candidates, and then when the federal candidates get active, we have them, because they have sometimes different lists, do a blast looking for asking people to sign up to be watchers. So there's sort of a recruitment that goes on, plus there's the existing file and a lot of repeat watchers.
Thank you. And then just kind of a follow-up to that, Martha, once you've kind of developed your universe of potential watchers, do you have some sort of rubric for narrowing it down to who those folks are going to be? I know that you all provide your own training, but, you know, kind of what's the next step once you've developed a universe of folks who are willing?
And I should add one more thing. Of course, we use the county chair, the party county chair, to also recruit if they have people who aren't on the list. So once the person indicates interest by going to the Colorado Dems website and clicking on I want to be a watcher, and then when they do that, they have to fill out a bunch of fields, contact information, availability information, whether they're experienced, have watched before. And then once they've done that and they're sort of in the file, that year's file, then we get them to a training. And if they don't come to a training and we don't know that they are a watcher that we have used in the past, then they don't get to watch. If they can't get to a training, but we know they have been a watcher in the past, we make sure they get our new materials. We try to get them on the webinar training, and so we try to get everybody trained. But if they can't do the training and they're sort of a newer person, then they don't watch.
Gotcha. Anybody else with experience in this area? I know, Marilyn, you're on the line representing the Republicans. Do you know if it's a similar process?
Some parts of it are, and I think particularly at the county level, for the Republican Party, it's my understanding that much of the watcher recruitment is done at the county level through the county party, and sometimes with the candidates. Many times it's candidates who are reaching out to get volunteer watchers. And in terms of at the state party level, I think that the process for recruiting attorneys, Republican attorneys who volunteer their time, is the same, and it has tended to be for functions near Election Day that those attorneys have tended to work for the party. Is there any particular other point that I should try to address there?
No, that may...
This is Shane. Sorry. I just had a question. Marilyn, are you saying that the Republicans recruit attorneys to act as watchers or in another function?
Generally as watchers. I think similar to what Martha was saying.
Okay, and then the party provides training?
Yes, I believe so. I don't know the level of training that they are providing to the attorneys. I presume that they do. Have you actually participated with them as a watcher on that training? You might know a lot better than I.
No, this is Shane again. My experience was a little different. It was not being recruited as a watcher. It was being recruited for facilitating challenges. So that's a kind of a different role.
Okay. Yes, in this past year, they did recruit a number of attorneys who did function as official watchers for the state party or at the county level as well.
Okay, thank you. So that, unless anybody else wants to comment on just kind of the appointment process, we did have Harvey, looks like Harvey wants to...
Well, in as much as I was a county chair for about 10 years, actually did recruit watchers, I at least want to make my knowledge base available.
Sure.
Well, I'm not sure what we're getting at or what's important about that experience, but I do know that there is a disconnect between the state party and the county parties on watching, which can be disturbing to a county chair. And I think Martha actually, you know, reflected that in her comments, because she was giving the state party perspective pretty much. And as a Democrat who wanted to be a watcher in a primary, I have asked various candidates at different levels in the different district levels, and been told that no, we don't need watchers to come to us. We have the lawyers are taking care of that, and it's, you know, we're not interested in people who call in to be watchers. So that might be relevant. You know, it's something I think we should think about watching in terms not only of a proactive process where the parties, the interested parties, the candidates seek out watchers, but then there's also the possibility there are people actually interested in watching who have experience who are approaching the parties and how they, what they experience also. So there's two sides to it.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, I think that's up to the party, you know, if they want to appoint or not appoint. But there is an issue about the party, the state and county disconnect that we want to get to, because the statute talks about the county chair appointing. And there have been issues sometimes in contacting the county chair. And, you know, do we want to have some kind of rule about... Or legislation about the default to the state chair if you either can't get a hold of a county chair, or in some counties we don't have county chairs for each party. There is no central committee of, you know, one or the other. And so, you know, at what point can the state chair then, and I think this probably is in your bylaws, or, you know, it may be more complicated than I think. But there have been issues in the past with, you know, who is eligible to make that appointment. Maybe Martha, you can start.
I think that's a really important point. And in fact, I would suggest that much of the problems that we experienced in Boulder last cycle were because the chair was out of the country for a few one of the chairs was out of the country for a few months, and right at the time when they were trying to get judges and watchers. So political party chairs are, county chairs are volunteers, and some of them are more accessible than others, and I think it would be good to have a way to, if the chair is not available, to have it default to the state chair. But I do think you need to protect the role of the county chair as well in the event that they are participating. One more thing I want to raise to Ben's comment, which was the process, because we talked about the appointing, you know, how we find watchers, but I did want to just reflect on the process, which goes back to the first topic we were talking about just a little bit, which is getting the county chairs to have to sign all those certificates and then get all those certificates to the county clerk and get them signed manually can be a huge problem. And that's, we didn't really talk about it from the county chair point when we were talking about it earlier, but that streamlining that process, and maybe that's part of the state chair appointing opportunity as well, because if we could centralize that and not have to get the county chair to sign, manually sign everything, that would be a huge help in terms of streamlining the process.
And so one of the things that we were kind of thinking about along that vein was kind of what Suzanne mentioned, which is that we don't exactly know. I mean, obviously the statute currently says the county chair, and this is really mostly for party appointment, but we've been curious about to what extent, you know, parties would have the leeway within their bylaws to, in the absence of a county chair, or in the case that the county chair is, you know, unresponsive, unwilling to basically, designate the state party to resolve an issue like that. You know, the statutes talk a lot about how the state party is the mechanism for resolving, you know, most county controversies. So that might just be something for the parties to think about, not necessarily something for the panel maybe to decide on, but to think about whether that's within the party's authority for their bylaws to do that. And then just kind of the second thing, kind of the reason for asking that question in response to Harvey's question is that we just simply don't understand that process as well as some of the other parts. And so we're trying to understand how to make it more efficient along the lines of what Martha said. When we polled the counties, the difference between one county to the next as to how that certificate gets out and how many certificates a watcher needs to have to go to each place and whether the appointing entity signs 50 forms and hands them off, those types of things. We've just are curious about the process so that we can, you know, update this map and then come up with ideas to streamline that process. So we've taken notes on that, and we appreciate you letting us know how that is. Our next question is something that we broached a little bit earlier, and it's really about the appointing entity and determining eligibility for a watcher. So before we talk about how that actually happens and how the appointing entities determine that a watcher is actually eligible under the law to be a watcher, we've got one more piece just to give everybody a refresher on what the eligibility requirements are.
So hi, it's Melissa again. So we made a separate handout for determining eligibility. These are essentially taken from Title I and from our rules, 1-1-104, sub 51, and 1-7-108 are the statutory citations that talk about when a watcher is eligible. We also have rules that expand or clarify watcher eligibility. And those are rules 8.2 and 8.8. So essentially, a watcher has to be an eligible elector in Colorado. has to be selected by an authorized appointing entity, referring to the last chart. A watcher cannot be a candidate on the ballot or a candidate's immediate family member by blood, marriage, or civil union to the second degree if you are watching for that candidate. If you're selected by a party chair, party candidate, or unaffiliated candidate, you must be affiliated with that party or unaffiliated. And in a recount, a candidate subject to the recount may appoint himself or herself as a member of the or a member of the candidate's family as a watcher at that recount. And those are essentially all of the eligibility requirements we could find in law.
And so not to, does anybody have any questions or comments generally about the current state of eligibility? Harvey?
So clearly this is a Title I compendium, and since I guess this is the time to bring up whether or not we are going to discuss the effect on Title, the municipal and special district elections, because they actually have differences to this list. And since they're here, I wonder what would be the appropriate time to discuss whether we should make consistency between those elections?
Well, I guess my comment to that would be that, you know, it would be great to hear from special districts and municipalities as to perhaps their process along this lines, although, you know, with the current state of the law as it is between Title 31, Title I, and then Article 13.5 of Title I, I'm not sure to what extent, you know, we really want to get into the idea of conforming, you know, outside of just looking at the watcher context, because I think that's a group, perhaps 10 groups to their own in order to figure that out. Does that make sense? I'm not sure to what extent this group should really take on the task of figuring out how to, you know, meld those things in the wake of you know, recent changes to law.
And this is Harvey Branscombe. I was assuming that the reason why there are four members representing special districts and municipalities is very relevant to this question. I mean, that makes sense that would be the reason why they're here, to be able to create consistency. And this group is supposed to advise the Secretary of State on potential changes in law. So I don't know why we wouldn't be addressing that. And it seems to me an important topic, and it definitely relates directly to watchers.
Sure. Well, and if the special district representatives or municipalities want to just chat about, you know, this area for watchers, I think that this is certainly a good time for that.
Actually, it's the same similar process. I mean, a candidate can appoint, an issues committee can appoint, and the appointing authority would be those entities. They would certify it to the DEO. We would verify that they were eligible, an eligible elector, excuse me, and then have the election judge administer the oath. So it's the same process.
Harvey Branscombe. So I forgot to mention the particular point I wanted to bring up is the eligible elector in Colorado versus eligible elector in the municipality or in the special district.
Definition of an eligible elector would be the eligible elector for that local government election, which would be an eligible elector in that special district or that municipality.
Right, and I'm understanding that so you're saying that only because there are federal elections in most county-run elections, not all, perhaps, county-run elections. But in any case, I think that there is a distinction there that ought to be made more uniform. So, and you know, perhaps that should be a separate topic at a separate moment. But in any case, I wanted to address the fact that Title I rules, at least, allow for any eligible elector in Colorado, as it says here on the top, to be a watcher in any Title I election. Oh, I'm not sure about our.
But if you look at the definition of eligible elector, it's eligible to vote in that local government election. whether it's county, whether it's municipality, whether it's special district.
Well, that definition you just described is Title 31, I believe.
Title 1.
So I think maybe Rule 1.1.46 in the Secretary of State's election rules states that a designated watcher need not be a resident of the county he or she is designated in as long as he or she is an eligible elector in the state of Colorado, which is a Title I rule, which would enhance the definition of eligible elector to not necessarily be only eligible in that particular district. So I think that's the difference.
But that's only for state elections under right. Title I. So if you want to watch in, you know, one county or another county, you can go do that as long as you're an eligible elector in the state. But that that is not the practice or law in the municipal or special district elections when they are not in a otherwise coordinated statewide election.
And you know,
Suzanne, to take the example in a coordinated election, let's say that the watcher wants to watch for a mayoral candidate of a town that he doesn't live in, but yet this is a coordinated election. It would seem that based on the fact it's coordinated in under the rule that the watcher doesn't have to live in that municipality. Is that correct?
Well, I think the watcher is being credentialed in that case, you know, through the standards in there. I mean, they may provide differently in the IGA, but I think that's up to the special districts and the municipalities. You know, what will a credentialed watcher be? And if they're interpreting that to be somebody who lives in their area, then I'm not sure we're going to be advising county clerks differently. I don't know. Jim, has that ever come up, or Liz, or, yeah, so, yeah.
Yes, Dave.
That has come up in Broomfield as a city and county. So we've just defaulted to the Title I interpretation. But it's an interesting topic, and I'll be sure to look into that more. But we've just defaulted to that for our position.
Okay. So it sounds like in Broomfield, you can be an eligible elector in the state and go in and watch.
And that's Denver just adopts Title I.
Yeah. So that's going to be a, you know, I think that's going to be a county by county, district by district, city by city issue. And we're not here to, the special districts and the cities were not invited so that we could take control over their elections. They were invited because they have issues in coordinated elections, and we want to get their input. And this is the secretary's committee, and if he chose to put four people on it to get that perspective, it's his committee, and he can put four people on it to get that perspective. And that's why they're here. And it's not so that we can dictate to them how they run their elections.
So this is Harvey Branscombe. So just to be clear, it's not clear, but there's a big difference between the eligibility of a watcher in a municipal election and in a county-run election, in that and it may be because of the reality of the districts that are covered by the election, but the reality is, in a municipal election, only electors within the municipality can be watchers, even though there may be expert watchers that the candidates might want to appoint, who are adjacent to the municipality but not actually resident within it. And in fact, ironically, the election judge appointments, the opposite, strangely enough, election judge appointments open to, at least in special districts, outside of the special district. So it's a big inconsistency that ought to be considered by someone somewhere sometime. So right. That's the point I want to make.
And you know what we can do is just note the Title 31 and Title 32 requirements as far as being an elector within the district on our chart here. But kind of the next piece that we wanted to get into, and I hate to keep harping on the folks here who are familiar with being appointing entities, but we've had some previous discussion about how do you confirm eligibility. And whose role it is to confirm eligibility. And our question is, for the appointing entities, how do you confirm the eligibility of your potential watchers before you appoint them?
I think that the Republican county chairs that I'm aware of, if they don't know the person to be, you know, one of their members or, you know, as a local, that they just check the voter registration rolls to make sure that person's a current eligible elector.
So this is Martha. What we do is we check them against the van to see if they're registered. But it does highlight for me the point that not everybody has that access. And so the political parties have it, but you know, issue committees wouldn't necessarily have it. Now, if they have the person's birth date, they could look them up on the Secretary of State's website. But other than if, and I can say that from our recruitment form, we don't ask for their birth date. It's not an important point. But I guess, you know, we have always understood that the county is going to double check that to make sure that we're not appointing somebody that we're not supposed to be appointing. But we do check it ourselves.
Well, and I think it was leading to sort of a discussion point that's maybe a broader one we can think about over lunch and not talk about, since we're going to turn the microphones off. But, you know, what if there was a some sort of system where you either had, and this is a question for the counties too, you either had the county check the eligibility or maybe you just attached proof of the eligibility with the form as an alternate so that you didn't have to go then get the additional approval. Is that sort of where we're heading, Ben?
It is. And so just to elaborate on a little bit, it's from our poll of the counties, it's also the case that most counties are also doing their review because, of course, they have access to SCORE, so why wouldn't they? They have access to the most up-to-date information about that individual and are able to determine whether that person is eligible to be a watcher by looking at that. And then kind of along what Suzanne was talking about is that we have folks, you know, watchers are appointed in different ways, as we've been talking about, and they're appointed at different times. And what we have heard is that, you know, there's oftentimes delays because the clerk needs to confirm that that person is eligible or desires to confirm that that person is eligible because they're unsure of any process prior to that to determine that that person was eligible. And so to provide that extra option for watchers to be able to show up with proof of eligibility would just be something that might be able to streamline the process, not necessarily being the only process, because, you know, the appointing entities oftentimes will submit lists and that type of thing in order for the clerk to be able to do that work beforehand. But this was just an idea to say, well, if you do have somebody that we call, say, maybe a walk-in voter at a voter service and polling center who hasn't gone through any of that yet and doesn't want to wait for the clerk to go check them and score, you know, it's really quite easy at this point for anybody who's a registered elector to get their voter registration record printed out and have it with them. So I don't know if you want to break for lunch, Suzanne, and let folks ponder on that, and then we can take that back up after.
Yeah, because this is going to be a big issue. You know, I don't know that the appointing entities are going to have issues with it because it just, you know, can speed up the process. But we don't know what the issues may be on the administrative, you know, clerk side. If there's a reason that, you know, you all want to be the people checking the eligibility, if you're keeping a list, if it's somehow going to you know, be a problem for you all. So yeah, maybe on that note, we can break for lunch, and then we can, then we have, I think we're about halfway through the MAC now. So are we tracking pretty well?
Yeah, we are. And I actually think that we've kind of, with this last subject we just brought up, that kind of brings up a few of the different steps. And so I think we're on a pretty good track here.
Okay. So maybe we'll break till 12:30 and have lunch, and then we'll reconvene at that point.